You are listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, Wisconsin has thousands of untested rape kits, packages of evidence from sexual assaults that could identify attackers by their DNA. We hear what's being done about that backlog. First, President Trump began his first foreign trip as president with a stop in Saudi Arabia. Yesterday, he gave a much-anticipated speech about Islam and its relationship to the West and to global terrorism.
Our vision is one of peace, security, and prosperity in this region and all throughout the world. Our goal is a coalition of nations who share the aim of stamping out extremism and providing our children a hopeful future that does honor to God.
Ishan Tharoor is with us now to take a deeper look at the address and how it was received. He writes about foreign affairs for The Washington Post and previously was a senior editor at Time. Ishan, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the choice of President Trump's first foreign visit is an interesting one. It seems that generally a new president may pick something lower-hanging fruit, Canada, maybe Mexico. What do you think it says that Trump chose Saudi Arabia to deliver a major speech there?
I think it's a fascinating choice, given, of course, Trump's rhetoric on the campaign trail, the very clearly anti-Muslim tone that he struck at various points, as well as his own critical words for Saudi Arabia in the build-up to the election. He has, invoked 9/11 and the Saudi role in that, and said all sorts of damning things about the Saudi state during the campaign. So it's a fascinating choice that he's there. I think it helps. He can say that this fits into his America First vision in a couple of ways. First of all, he secured this mega deal with the Saudis, selling hundreds of billions of dollars, potentially, worth of arms to the kingdom. This is a sale that Trump can say, gives us new jobs in the U.S. and will stoke further investment from the Saudis as well. And so that fits into his sort of agenda to improve the American economy at home. And then he's also, by giving the Saudis all this armament and all these new sophisticated weapon systems and other technologies, the Trump White House can say, look, we've given a regional partner more tools to do the job that we don't have to do anymore. And this is part of also the America First desire to, if not retreat from the world, but get other countries to share the burden of regional security in the Middle East.
I want to talk about one of the more striking aspects of the speech, and you're getting at some of this there. I mean, in the past, President and candidate Trump have said that Islam hates America. Trump has called for the Muslim ban from 7 Muslim-majority nations, a Muslim registry. And in this speech, he, for instance, called Islam one of the world's great religions and called for unity.
This is not a battle between different faiths, different sects, or different civilizations. This is a battle between barbaric criminals who seek to obliterate human life and decent people, all in the name of religion. People that want to protect life and want to protect their religion. This is a battle between good and evil. When we see the scenes of destruction in the wake of terror, we see no signs that those murdered were Jewish or Christian, Shia or Sunni. When we look upon the strains of innocent blood soaked into the ancient ground, we cannot see the faith or sect or tribe of the victims. We see only that they were children of God whose deaths are an insult to all that is holy.
How does that difference in tone strike you?
Look, at this point, I don't think we can really be surprised anymore by the inconsistencies and contradictions in Trump's rhetoric. He clearly does not seem to be fazed by it. But I think it's important to note that the Saudis themselves have been saying, especially since Trump came into office, the Saudis have been saying that, look, whatever he said on the campaign trail is water under the bridge. They really care about the fact that the Trump White House, this new presidency, gives them a chance to reset relations with Washington, relations with which they saw had frayed under the Obama administration because of Obama's perceived friendliness to Iran, which is Saudi Arabia's kind of regional nemesis. And everything, and you heard that on the speech on Sunday, everything really ultimately was about Iran. Trump's speech has been discussed as this whole new take on Islam, this reboot with the Muslim world. But ultimately, what it really was not even anything about religion. It was about the Trump White House signaling that the Saudi agenda in the Middle East is now also our agenda. And that is an interesting and perhaps worrying development, which we can discuss more, I guess.
Well, Trump has been vocal about being very opposed to the Iran nuclear deal. And in his speech, as you said, he came out very strongly against Iran and called it a sponsor of terrorism on several levels.
From Lebanon to Iraq to Yemen, Iran funds arms and trains terrorists, militias, and other extremist groups that spread destruction and chaos across the region. For decades, Iran has fueled the fires of sectarian conflict and terror. It is a government that speaks openly of mass murder, vowing the destruction of Israel, death to America, and ruin for many leaders and nations in this very room.
Right. Well, this is longstanding. The Saudis and the Iranians have a huge rivalry that's been very damaging for the Middle East in many ways for a number of years. The Saudis really were upset about the inking of the nuclear deal with Iran by the Obama administration. And, of course, it should be known, a number of other significant world powers who all had a desire to both curb Iran's nuclear program and bring that country back into the fold of the international community. The Saudis weren't happy with that. And have been pushing back against it in various ways. Trump has loudly campaigned against the nuclear deal, mostly for opportunistic political reasons, because you're not seeing any actual groundwork in Washington now to unravel this deal. And so this is rhetoric that fit into the Saudi plan. I mean, the Saudis really want to reassert themselves in the region. This is a country that has great economic largesse, but also sees itself as at the vanguard, at the helm of the Sunni world. And Iran is the only opponent in their way. And so to have Trump on side now for them is incredibly important.
If you're Iran and you're listening to this kind of language and rhetoric coming from the mouth of the new president of the United States, what do you think?
Well, I think it's a bit concerning. Iran, of course, the irony of this whole weekend was that Iran just held what is in effect a genuine election. They had a presidential election on Friday where the sitting president, Hassan Rouhani, was reelected by a significant margin. He's a relative moderate. He's not really a reformist candidate, but he's a relative moderate within the regime. And he defeated a very hardline anti-American figure who was himself opposed to the nuclear deal and who was more closely aligned with other institutions within the Iranian regime, like the Supreme Leader and the very, very infamous Revolutionary Guards. So it's a complicated situation, but what this whole weekend exposed was that while Iran has a quasi-democratic process and has real internal fissures and debates, Trump is siding with the absolute monarchy in Saudi Arabia, that where only one family has all control over the levers of power. And if you're an Iranian watching Trump say basically what the Saudis want to say, you can imagine that the hardline, more staunchly anti-American forces within the country feel a bit validated. That, look, what is the point of extending our hand to the rest of the world when we get an American administration that has no interest in our making any concessions, in our trying to open up, and effectively is calling for regime change instead of diplomacy.
Ishan Tharoor is with us right now. He writes about foreign affairs for the Washington Post, and he's with us to talk about President Trump's speech yesterday in Saudi Arabia about Islam, about terrorism, and the West. And in terms of terrorism, what was the message that came up yesterday in President Trump's speech?
Well, Trump did not bang on about quote-unquote radical Islamic terror in the way he has over the campaign trail and in, you know, various speeches back home. That was not really in his messaging.
He didn't even use that term, right?
he didn't use that term such as was. He did say Islamic extremism. But in terms of the message, it wasn't the kind of clash of civilizations that he and some of his advisors in particular have been invoking over the past year. Rather, it was this kind of call for unity, a call for rallying around sort of civilization against barbarism. He urged leaders in the Arab world and in Muslim-majority countries to drive out extremists in their midst. It was a pretty direct but not particularly novel message. What I think was very interesting is if you hold up against Trump's speech against what President Obama said in Cairo in 2009, I think this is really crucial in understanding what the Trump administration was doing, delivering the speech in the first place. The Obama speech was directed towards normal Arab people, to the Arab street. It was talking about the issues that mattered to them, questions about democracy, the repressive roles of various regimes, the desire for young people to get jobs. It was aware of the real drivers that fuel radicalization. None of that was apparent in Trump's speech. He didn't talk about the causes of extremism, and he didn't address Arab people. He didn't address his speech was very specifically, you know, in the shadow of the Saudi king, addressed to leaders, to authoritarian governments, without any recognition or interest in the political and perhaps democratic aspirations of tens of millions of people in the region.
And Ishan, as we wrap up, just briefly, if you had to read the tea leaves, what does this speech and this visit to Saudi Arabia in particular augur for foreign relations and the U.S. approach to foreign policy?
I mean, this is the huge question that we as observers and journalists always are trying to answer with the Trump White House. You get the sense that at the end of the day, Trump, as a former businessman, really sees the world through transactional deals, and there's not much of a big picture grand strategy in place. So while he can play very nice to the Saudis now and ink all these deals, maybe in a few weeks from now back somewhere else, his whole message will change, and he may throw the Saudis under the bus or criticize their government for fueling Wahhabi extremism. Who knows? The whole situation with this White House is that they seem to be groping for strategies without really settling on one. And maybe that'll emerge in the future, but for now, what we can take away from the speech is, yes, Trump came to Saudi Arabia with this whole stigma of his anti-Muslim rhetoric and then completely fell hook, line, and sinker for the Saudi narrative of the world and talked tough in Iran, said nothing about democracy and human rights, and then went away with hundreds of billions of dollars in his proverbial pocket.
Ishan, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Ishan Tharoor writes about foreign affairs for the Washington Post and previously was a senior editor at Time. He joined us to talk about President Trump's speech yesterday in Saudi Arabia about Islam, terrorism, and the West. 3 years ago, a groundbreaking study found that thousands of packages of sexual assault evidence in Wisconsin had never been tested. The survey found that there was a backlog of rape kits from police agencies in 173 communities. The state's Department of Justice has received $4 million in grants to study and test the evidence. But there have been criticisms of the state legislature for not doing enough to target the untested rape kits to focus more on crime labs. Keegan Kyle is an investigative reporter for USA Today Network Wisconsin, and he's been covering the story. And he joins us now to talk about some of the latest developments. Keegan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
First off, Keegan, what exactly, remind us, is a rape kit? And do we know at this point, as we stand today, how many remain untested in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so a rape kit is a colloquial term that we use to describe evidence taken after an allegation of sexual assault. So usually there will be a forensic exam done by a nurse to collect biological material off of a person that will hopefully help down the road to identify a suspect or to corroborate statements at a trial or to investigators.
And you recently got access to a lot of documents that shed some new light on the process behind these rape kits and the politics also. Can you tell us about the documents that you got access to?
Yeah, we've requested under state open records laws hundreds of pages of documents that were part of grant applications for federal grant programs in both 2015 and 2016. And those documents confirmed a lot that we had previously known about the state's untested evidence, but it also revealed some new information about the evidence and provided some nuances to things that we had kind of heard already.
And you say there are, you group it into six revelations. We'll see how many we can get to. We'll hit most of them probably. But starting with when the term backlog has been controversial, Attorney General Brad Schimmel has said in some cases this is not a backlog. We're doing our due diligence here and kits are being tested. Tell us about the history of that word.
Sure. So the Attorney General and top Department of Justice officials over the past few months have vigorously objected to the use of the word backlog to describe the thousands of untested kits. And their reasons are partially historical because about a decade ago, the Department of Justice came under a lot of public scrutiny because it had a backlog of current evidence from new cases that was not being tested quickly at the state crime lab. And the department has distinguished that backlog from the current backlog because the untested sexual assault evidence is accumulated over decades, in some cases more than two decades ago. And so by objecting to the word backlog, they've partially wanted to distance themselves from blame for this new accumulation of evidence. So in a lot of cases, it's not necessarily the state who is telling people to not send evidence to a crime lab. That decision is being made locally by a police department. So there are a lot of people involved in deciding why evidence wasn't tested. And then another reason why I think they've objected to the word backlog is because it can provide a rationale for why the evidence wasn't tested long ago. Was it always intended to be evidence and it's just been sitting there collecting dust? Or what they've been saying is that we've now changed our opinion of this evidence and we now want to get it tested. So those have been some factors in why they've objected to the word. But as you mentioned, we got documents that show they have repeatedly used the word themselves in applications to federal grant authorities. The Attorney General himself signed a letter in May 2015 that used the word, and we thought it was important for our readers to know about these discrepancies.
Another revelation from these documents that you got access to was the way that law enforcement may have interacted with victims. Now, this is a paper trail of evidence. We don't have specific cases, it sounds like, but what do we know about this so far?
Right. This was really important because to date, what we've mostly heard about, kind of the story behind Wisconsin's backlog, is that the explanation is a lot of innocuous in a lot of cases where, you know, evidence wasn't tested because somebody was already convicted, or the evidence is just being held for appellate reasons, or victims withdrew their allegations, and so police believe there wasn't an assault. What these documents show is that the Department of Justice was very concerned that in hundreds of cases, police departments had described victims as uncooperative or unreliable, and they were concerned that these police detectives may have had poor training to recognize like the signs of trauma. So they might view someone's signs of trauma from a sexual assault as being untrustworthy, and then pressuring that person into recanting their allegation. And so they made these comments as part of an application to federal grant authorities for more than $1 million in programs for victim services and also to help with law enforcement training.
I want to get to more of your points, but real quickly, Keegan, where does that stand? Has that training and the victim support services money been used? Has it started to go into effect?
Yes. So the grant was approved last fall. And the just this past April, the Department of Justice put out applications for local organizations to start getting funding for victim services.
And another aspect here we should talk about is the progress on getting these kits tested and what the Department of Justice has said its approach has been. And there's been different takes on how they're proceeding with this. The term forklift comes into effect here. I'll let you explain that. Tell us more about what you learned there.
Yeah. So one of the main points of criticism of the Attorney General and the Department of Justice over this backlog has been how long it's been taken to both research it and then to start testing evidence from it. So the discovery of this backlog can be traced all the way back to 2012, when then Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen created this team to kind of research sexual assault evidence. It wasn't then until 2014 and we first kind of got our look at 6,000 kits. And now today, the state has estimated that they've only tested still about 63 packages of evidence. So there are still thousands of packages of evidence that have not been tested, and that's led to a lot of scorn from people about why is that taking so long? Why isn't the process moving along more quickly?
And in terms of how the state has gone forward with that, what have they said about this?
Yeah, they now have a plan in place where they're sending 200 kits per month to a private lab to get tested. So over the next 2 years, roughly, they expect that much of the evidence will be tested or at least sent to labs. So we're going to kind of slowly get through this, but the process has started where evidence is being shipped to labs for testing.
And Keegan, as we wrap up, just briefly, another thing demonstrated in these documents was the desire to have some positive, it sounds like, publicity or media coverage about the process at the DOJ. What did you learn?
It was a few days after we published a story in early February about the Attorney General misrepresenting how much evidence had been tested. We found emails in these documents that indicate that a contractor was seeking federal approval to get some positive media out for the state and to release more information about the kits.
Keegan, thank you so much for coming in to talk today. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was Keegan Kyle, investigative reporter for USA Today Network, Wisconsin. And he was here with us in studio to talk about the latest investigative reporting into Wisconsin's thousands of untested rape kits. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. In his book Evicted, Poverty and Profit in the American City, author Matthew Desmond exposed the tenuous and often invisible lives of poor residents of Milwaukee. It won him the 2017 Pulitzer Prize. In a recent piece for the New York Times, Desmond compares the experiences of renters and homeowners across the country and examines the policies that have made the gulf between those who own and those who rent one of the greatest divides in our country. You can find a link to that article on the Central Time Facebook page. Matthew Desmond is an associate professor of the social sciences and co-director of the Justice and Poverty Project at Harvard University. He received his PhD in 2010 from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Matthew, welcome to Central Time.
It's good to be here.
Well, Matthew, let's start with the mortgage income deduction. Could you tell us what it is and where it first came from?
It's called a mortgage interest deduction.
Sorry, interest,
and
correct.
What it is a entitlement for all homeowners in America who itemize their deductions, and they can deduct all the interest they pay on their first home up to $1 million, and on their second home up to, I think, $100,000. They can deduct that interest and save quite a bit on their tax returns. It wasn't intended to be an enormous entitlement is what it became. It started in 1913 as a general policy that allowed businesses to deduct all interest. But that was a time where most Americans didn't pay income tax, and it's a time where most Americans didn't own their homes. And as that changed over the 20th century, the mortgage interest deduction became one of the biggest, most generous deductions in the tax code. And the most recent data suggests that, it cost us about $71 billion last year. And if you add that up to other homeowner subsidies, the price tag for this benefit is about $134 billion. So it started as something of an accident, but became something that's just fundamental to the American welfare state.
Who benefits the most from that today?
So you can claim a bigger deduction if you have a bigger mortgage, and obviously you can get a bigger mortgage if you have a bigger income. So the folks that benefit the most from this entitlement are affluent families, and so about 4/5 of the entire deduction from the mortgage interest deduction go to families with six-figure incomes. That's a big, big benefit going to upper-income families. And there's also racial and economic differences here because legacies of racial discrimination. Most white families today own their own home, but most African-American and Hispanic families don't. And so most white families are entitled to this deal, but most non-white families are not.
And you say that we should think about the mortgage interest deduction the same way we think about, for example, Medicaid. Can you talk more about that?
Well, it's just it's a big entitlement. It costs a lot of money. And it's been seen for years and years as this kind of third rail of politics, kind of this untouchable benefit that is just going to lose you a bunch of political points if you try to take it on. So it's become something like Medicaid in its ability to withstand all kind of political transitions, and it was only altered once in its entire history.
And you write about it in the sense, though, that we may be thinking about people who get government money, maybe entitlements, as you know, the sort of welfare queen idea from the Reagan era. But you say this is analogous with that at the same fundamental level.
It's important. I think it's important to think about the welfare state in really big terms. And I think that, like I said in the piece in the Times magazine, you know, a 15-story public housing complex and a mortgaged suburban home, they're both government subsidized housing, but only one looks that way, you know, and we tend to benefit middle class and upper class Americans through the tax code, and we tend to benefit Americans of modest means by writing checks or building buildings. And I just think it's important that when it comes to what we're spending on housing today, the biggest beneficiaries are not low-income families, but are the affluent homeowners.
I want to talk about this on a personal level, and that's what you did. You talked to a number of families, and you looked at how this was playing out in their lives and the lives of their children. Can you tell us about a couple of these families, some of who maybe were the beneficiaries of the mortgage interest deduction and those who were renters without that?
Sure. So one of the families I met, the lead person I spoke to was a guy named Vinny. And Vinny was a middle-income homeowner. He lived in a suburb of Boston. He and his new wife had a little baby at home, and they're first-time homeowners. And they itemize their deductions, so they do claim the mortgage interest deduction. And so this is kind of what we want, right? We want young families starting an nest egg, getting into homeownership situation, but he didn't get that much of a benefit from this. You know, he basically saved a little less than $40 a month from the mortgage interest deduction. Now, compare Vinny to another family I met who lives in Milton, Massachusetts, which is a Asari family. Now, the Asari family, they're better off. They're upper middle class. You know, their combined income is about $10,000 shy of $300,000 a month. And they have a four-bedroom home. It's their second home. And so the mortgage interest deduction, their claim is just under $400 a month. You know, so it's a big difference by what the Asari family receives from this benefit and what a family like Vinny receives from the benefit, even though the Asari family arguably needs it a lot less than Vinny does. And then for me anyways, a really important part of the story is just to think of the one-third of Americans, the one-third of renting households that are just completely left out of this bargain. And I think that a lot of Americans, when we think of the typical low-income family, we think of them living in public housing or benefiting from some other kind of assistance from the government, like a housing voucher. But the opposite is true. Only about one in four of all families in America who qualify for housing assistance get it. So the majority, the unlucky majority of renting families receive zero help from the government. And if they're below the poverty line, most of them spend at least half of their income on housing costs today. So for me, what we have in America is a housing policy that gives most help to families that arguably need it the least, and gives no help to most families that need it the most.
We're talking with Matthew Desmond right now from Harvard University, talking about his New York Times Magazine piece called How Home Ownership Became the Engine of American Inequality. By the way, you can read that on the Central Time Facebook page. And Matthew, why has owning a home become such a bedrock of a way that a family might accumulate wealth over the years?
So homeownership has always been seen as deeply American. And it's been seen as something that our founding fathers knotted up with citizenship. The very idea of what it means to be an American was, you know, embodied in this symbolic idea of the Yemen farmer, you know, sweating and toiling over his own piece of land. And that's part of our DNA. That's part of our national DNA. And but America hasn't always been a nation of homeowners. You know, this was really forged in the New Deal, with things especially like the GI Bill and the federal insuring of private mortgages that allowed many, many veterans and other folks to own their own home with very little money down and kind of use that as a foothold into the middle class. You know, owning a home is it's a savings compeller. When you're paying a mortgage, you're compelled to put something away. And in many markets, you know, your home is worth a lot more 5-10 years later than it is when you buy it. So, you know, the wealth differences between homeowners and renters are enormous. The average homeowner is 36 times better off when it comes to their net worth than the average renter in America.
Hmm. And you were talking earlier about how this has privileged white Americans over people of color all the way back to the GI Bill, when you had processes like redlining, which kept African Americans from getting those loans and owning homes.
It's an important part of our history. And, you know, this is an argument that a lot of other folks have made. And in my piece, I draw off a wonderful book called When Affirmative Action Was White by the Columbia historian Ira Katznelson. And, you know, he articulates really clearly with a lot of proof how African-American veterans and families were excluded from New Deal policies that propelled many white families into the middle class. And I think that a lot of listeners, especially if they're young and they're my age, it's hard for us to, like, imagine how massive the GI Bill was. But it was this huge piece of social legislation. You know, in the years after World War II, it consumed, I think, 15% of the federal budget. I mean, this thing was colossal. And, you know, one of the big things it did was allow returning soldiers access to homeownership. So in the years following World War II, you know, 40% of home loans were veteran mortgages. You know, they had low interest rates. They were great. There was a great benefit. But the problem was, now, many African Americans were excluded both at the federal level and at the local level when it comes to implementation from benefiting from that benefit. You know, FDR had to contend with the Southern wing of the Democratic Party in Congress, so he made concessions, you know, and they were concessions that upheld the racial status quo. And, you know, if you were an African-American family that somehow still qualified for the GI Bill, you still had to contend often with local VA centers and other administrative organizations like banks, like you said, which also were loyal to Jim Crow. And so, you know, we directly inherit that history and that legacy. You know, most folks that buy their first home today, you know, they get help from their parents, right? And their parents often are able to give that help because they've saved and because they're able to refinance their home and pull out some equity to give to their children. And so I think that's an important thing to recognize when it comes to thinking about the inequality that this benefit amplifies.
Matthew Desmond stays with us right now as we talk about how the gulf between people who own their homes and those who rent illustrates some of the largest divides in the United States. And you can read his New York Times Magazine piece. It's called How Home Ownership Became the Engine of American Inequality on the Central Time Facebook page. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. If you bought your own home, how'd you do it? Were you able to get that help from a family member? And how did they have the money to help, if you trace that back far enough? Or if you haven't been able to buy a home, what's been standing in your way? Do you feel like you've been hurt over the years, maybe by race, maybe by employment or another factor in that process? And how much do you count on being able to get tax breaks passed on from owning your own home? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll continue our conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert, and we're continuing our conversation about how owning a home came to be part of the American dream, or at least the American aspiration, the hope, and why there's now such a huge gulf between people who own those homes and people who rent, and what it means for their economic futures. And we hope that you'll join us now at 800-642-1234. If you are renting, what struggles do you face? Are you renting by choice, or is buying a home outside of your reach? And have you ever been evicted or had your home foreclosed on? What led to that, and how has that impacted you? You can call us at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. And let's take our first caller now. We have Jessica joining us in Milwaukee as we pick up with Matthew Desmond from Harvard University. Jessica, hi.
Hi. Thank you so much for having me on.
Sure. What did you want to share?
I just wanted to say a small comment that it's really great that we're talking about these, especially right now, because this summer is the 50th anniversary of the open housing marches in Milwaukee for fair and open housing. And we are still seeing such an amazing struggle and a large amount of disparity, particularly in Milwaukee housing, both in rentals and in home buying. And so it's just amazing that 50 years later, we're still in this position. I can take any sort of response off the air.
Jessica, thank you. And Matthew, what do you say to that?
It's an important point. And, you know, Milwaukee is a city that had an open housing struggle that failed. And the city remains an incredibly segregated and divided city today. And for me, you know, writing this piece and trying to understand the link between benefits that affluent homeowners get and the lack of benefits that so many renters get, and how that traces along lines of poverty and lines of racial division, is important, you know, because it shows that, you know, we are all connected here, you know, and the only road to real reform, as is some folks that have a little more, share a bit off their plate. There's no other road to real reform. And the open housing marches that crossed the Menominee Valley in Milwaukee 50 years ago recognize that fact. And I think that we as a nation need to start having a larger conversation, a searching conversation, about how the benefits that we claim on our tax records and how our neighborhoods and how our schools are directly connected to underperforming neighborhoods or underperforming schools, or the lack of benefits that some of our neighbors receive or don't receive.
Jessica, thank you so much for that. And I want to get back to callers, but Matthew, I wanted to ask you, you said that Washington hasn't had, on either side of the aisle, an appetite for the kind of reform that you're talking about. Can you tell us a little bit about why that is?
Well, it's really tough to reform a benefit that's baked into the budgets of so many Americans, and not just any Americans. These are typically Americans that make up the voting base of both parties. You know, of both parties. And so even certain politicians who are on the progressive side of things and support legislation to combat inequality, those politicians often find themselves on the coast, you know, like Nancy Pelosi in San Francisco, and have been very reluctant to go after a benefit that disproportionately benefits their constituents. So that's one thing. And the other thing to recognize is just, you know, the real estate lobby is very powerful. And when we think of lobbies in Washington, I think we often think of the NRA gun lobby, big pharmaceutical lobbies, and they clearly are a force. But the realtors are much bigger spenders. They were second only to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in terms of spending last year. They spent almost $65 billion. Or million dollars, excuse me, $65 billion would be incredible, $65 million on lobbying efforts last year. And so they're a well-organized, well-heeled, powerful group, and they support the mortgage interest deduction and other homeowner subsidies.
Let's take another call. We've got Matt next in Stevens Point. Hi, Matt.
Hello.
What did you want to share?
I just wanted to share a small thought here. I mean, homeownership... according to Desmond, there's more to it. You know, I'm burdened with a township tax that far exceeds what I would get back in my interest deduction. And I mean, that among other things, the cost of owning a home, yard work. I have a home out in the country. I was blessed with a family that did help me get started. So he has a good point there. You know, the wealth is transferred, but it's not just... It's not money for nothing. You know, there's a lot of money to go into owning a home, and it's hard. It's a struggle every month for me to make my payments. And I'm a lower middle class guy, and I think every lower middle class citizen that owns a home would agree with me. It's hard to make that payment, and I think that should be a goal for everybody. And if you start taking away that deduction and make it harder to own a home, then you're starting to kill that goal for more than just the lower income families. I think it should start at home. People should be taught to strive to own a home.
Matt, thank you so much for your thoughts there. What do you say to that, Matthew? He's saying he needs that deduction. This is hard work owning a home, and it costs a lot of money.
I think Matt has a good point. And I would say for someone like Matt in a position like that, that, you know, the mortgage interest deduction isn't doing a lot for him. You know, and that's part of the issue. You know, it's doing a lot for folks that aren't struggling to make those payments. And it's doing a lot for folks that have homes that are worth $700,000, $800,000, $900,000. That's where the benefit is really cashing in. And so what my piece suggests, it suggests a very modest modification to the mortgage interest deduction, which is to cap the amount that you can deduct at $500,000. And that, by some estimates, would only affect about 5% of all mortgages in the United States. But the savings would be colossal. By one estimate, we would save about $87 billion over the next decade. And if that money could be transferred to affordable homeownership, and even to be transferred to help Americans of modest means who do own their homes, that would be something that I think would make a lot of sense. And I think that would be a step in the right direction. I would say, you know, one thing that Matt brought up is, you know, the question, does this benefit incentivize homeownership? And the economic literature is pretty equivocal on the answer, and the answer is no. It doesn't help you become a homeowner, because the biggest obstacle to that is a down payment, you know, and this is not something that this benefit helps. What this benefit does do is incentivize us to buy bigger homes and more expensive homes than we could if it didn't exist. So it does inflate homeownership values, especially toward the top end of the mortgage market.
Matthew, thanks a lot for talking today.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here. Thanks.
That was Matthew Desmond, a sociologist at Harvard University, and he got his PhD in 2010 from the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And you can find this New York Times Magazine article we've been talking about by Matthew called How Homeownership Became the Engine of American Inequality. You can find that on the Central Time Facebook page.